when I looked at my placement on the program and saw that I was coming after a discussion of Europe and before a discussion on Latin America, I have to say, as a policymaker, my job seems much easier than the problems of the rest of the world. So I appreciate the placement that I was put on today. Despite the fact that our problems may be a little simpler than those that were just described in the previous panel, there's still some interesting challenges that we have. But more often than not, I would say that we're quite fortunate in the United States that we're at a very different point in our economic recovery than most of the rest of the world. And I know you had Esther George here to start out the program, and she talked a little bit about the balance sheet. I think you're going to find some areas where there's a lot of commonality, and then some differences and nuances that I'll talk a little bit about. So in terms of the economy, I did read Esther. I wasn't here for the first day, unfortunately, and this morning was a wonderful set of panels. But last night I did get a chance to read her speech, and I think in terms of the economy, we're pretty much in the same place. So unlike the ECB, we have a dual mandate, so we have to worry about both inflation and unemployment. And the good news is we're pretty close to our dual mandate, that both aspects of our dual mandate are relatively close. So on the unemployment rate side, we have an unemployment rate at 4.5%. By historical standards, that's quite good. It's actually below my estimate of full employment, which is 4.7%. It's at the low end of where my peers on the FOMC think full employment is. So at least by the standard U3 measure of unemployment, we're pretty much where we want to be in terms of labor markets. In terms of inflation, I'd say we're still a little soft relative to our 2% target. Right now, total PCE is actually slightly above 2%, 2.1%. Core PCE is at 1.8%. But we're fluctuating around our 2% target. So in many respects, we're very close on the inflation target as well as the unemployment rate. So that's very good news, and that's one reason why we're in a very different place than Europe or Japan, and that we're now talking about a very positive thing, which is how do we normalize policy that has been extraordinarily accommodative over the last 10 years, and in my view, very appropriately so. And the balance sheet, I think, was actually, it only got a little discussion in that previous panel, but I think the balance sheet has been a very important tool, not only for the Federal Reserve, but for central banks around the world. And so I'm going to focus my remarks on the balance sheet as a tool and talk a little bit about how we should think about the normalization process. Now, at the outset, I would say there was a very good reason for us to be expanding the balance sheet. And during the financial crisis, I was very, very supportive of expanding the Federal Reserve balance sheet. The reason is very simple. We got the normal way that we conduct monetary policy is by moving short-term interest rates. We got our federal funds rate basically down to zero, but we still had an unemployment rate that was very high and an inflation rate that was very low. So we weren't achieving the objectives that we had for monetary policy. So we had to look at another tool that would enable us to actually stimulate the recovery and get back to where we're supposed to be. And so that tool was to purchase long-term assets, mostly treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities, with the intention of flattening the yield curve. So even though the short-term interest rates had hit zero, long-term rates had not hit zero, and that gave us the option to do a policy that flattened the yield curve that would stimulate the economy. In my own view, that stimulus was very much needed and is one of the reasons why we've had the recovery that we've had to date. So we've had a role of an expanded balance sheet, and I think one of the focuses of my comments today is that some people are viewing this as possibly a once-in-a-lifetime event, that it was a reaction to the very severe economic outcomes that we had as a result of the financial crisis. And so they're thinking about the balance sheet and normalizing the balance sheet in a framework that's thinking that this is a one-time event. My own view is a little bit different, and it really highlights the fact that there are changes in the macroeconomy that I think are actually quite critical, some of which Peter brought up in his presentation. We've had much lower productivity, not only in Europe, but in the United States as well. Around the world, we have lower inflation rates. And around the world, population trends. We have aging populations around the world. We have lower birth rates. In many countries, we're also seeing less in-migration. Well, that means that the population growth's not nearly as substantial either. So the combination of low inflation and low potential growth because of some of the population and demographic variables means that we're not going to have very much of a buffer when we're thinking about monetary policy. And as a result, I'm expecting that it's not going to be that uncommon that in recessions, we get the federal funds rate, or whatever our target at that time is, down very close to zero, requiring us to think about balance sheet outcomes again. And I think that's going to be true in Japan. I think it's going to be true in Europe, unless either countries pick a higher inflation target, or unless countries are able to find a way to get potential GDP to be growing much faster. So in terms of the future use of the balance sheet, Federal Reserve policymakers are asked every quarter about a wide set of economic variables. And I'm not going to talk about the wide set of economic variables, but I am going to talk about where we think the federal funds rate will be in the long run. So that's one of the questions we're asked at every summary of economic projections, where when we're at full complement, we have 12 Reserve Bank presidents and we have 7 governors. And the interest rate that they think we're going to have in the long run for the federal funds rate, which is the short-term rate that we affect for monetary policy, is that it's likely to only be 3%. Well, 3% is not very much room between 0 and 3%, which means that if you have a recession that requires more monetary policy accommodation than 3%, you're going to be back to zero again. In other words, the 300 basis points is probably not much of a cushion, which means in a standard recession, we've normally increased much more than 300 basis points or decreased much more than 300 basis points. And as a result, if we have standard recessions going forward, we're likely to be at the zero lower bound again in the future, which just means that we're going to have to do balance sheet activities again in the future. And so as we think about the balance sheet normalization, we should be thinking about this as a more standard monetary policy tool, not as a once-in-a-lifetime exceptional action. And so you think a little bit differently about it if you're thinking about this as a fairly standard tool of monetary policy going forward. Now, I would argue that there is a big difference between the balance sheet and short-term interest rates. Central banks around the world have a lot of experience moving short-term interest rates in order to meet their objectives, either an inflation target like in Japan or in Europe, or in the Federal Reserve, worrying about both inflation and the unemployment rate. So we have a lot of historical experience, we have a lot of statistical work that's been done, so we have a pretty good idea that if we change the federal funds rate by a certain amount, not with perfect certainty by any means, but with a lot more certainty than other tools, we have an idea of what the impact will be on the economy. The balance sheet, we basically have one observation in the US, Japan, and Europe. And to date, nobody has successfully exited from a very large balance sheet. So it makes sense that our primary tool should be the short-term rate. The secondary tool is the balance sheet that primarily gets taken out at times when we can't use that short-term rate. Well, that has implications for what an exit strategy ought to look like. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that over the course of my time. First, I'm going to argue that any kind of exit strategy should be very gradual. And I would argue it should be pretty soon. That if it's very gradual, it's much less likely to disrupt markets. And what we're really talking about with shrinking the balance sheet is how quickly or how slowly do we reinvest securities that are coming due. So people aren't talking about selling securities. They're talking about as a security comes due, how much of those proceeds do we reinvest? And we can do that at either a gradual rate or we could do it at a very quick rate. I'm arguing it should be gradual enough that it doesn't have sizable effects on financial markets and the economy, and that we should be using the short-term interest rate as the main tool to try to achieve our targets related to inflation and unemployment. So the shrinkage of the balance sheet should primarily be in the background, not as a fine-tuning tool, but as a tool that we do take out when we have recessions and when we can't use our short-term tool. So I'm going to take you through a whole bunch of graphs. I don't speak as much in words. I know Esther had a speech. I kind of speak through graphs. So I'm going to talk a little bit about graphs, some of which are going to hit some of the highlights. Peter had a similar chart in his packet. This first chart done a little differently than the one that he had. So it's looking, there are three different lines here. So the United States, this is the short-term interest rate. So in the United States, it's the federal funds rate. And, you know, that's in dark, I guess, purple. The euro area is in orange, and Japan is in green. Now, the first thing to notice is that you don't want to be Japan. They've had interest rates that were stuck at zero, and they've been stuck basically at zero for a very long time. In my view, that's the consequence of not acting aggressively when you have a really bad shock to your economy. And if you don't act aggressively, the result is that you stay at the zero lower bound much longer than anybody wants to. So there is a cost to deciding not to aggressively tackle a problem, and I think that problem is actually shown by what you're seeing in Japan. Now you can see the European and US lines are a little bit different. We have the ability to move our short-term rates until the financial crisis, and we didn't hit the zero lower bound at the previous recession, so we didn't have to use a balance sheet. But as you get to the financial crisis, you can see that we dropped our interest rates very quickly down to zero, much faster than what occurred in Europe. And our economies recovered more quickly, and I would argue it's kind of it's a combination of a lot of things, but it's in part a combination of a very aggressive monetary policy taken early on and the fact that we had the ability to address some of our banking problems a little bit more expeditiously than other places in the world. And you can see that we've started the normalization process. Now, it's a very gradual normalization process. We increased the federal funds rate in December 2015 and December 2016, and then most recently last month in March. So we've tightened three times, 75 basis points, and this is the part. We started our normalization process. So of the three, we're the first one to be able to move the short-term interest rates. And the idea was that we'd move short-term interest rates first so that if we did have a negative shock, we'd have the ability to work with the tool that we had the most confidence in so we could bring it back down if we had to, and hopefully we don't have to. So we have had those three tightenings. So a logical question is, what do you do with the balance sheet? So this shows the balance sheet in the same three. And you can see what I've done is I've standardized it relative to January of 2000. So the way to think of this is, what was the path of these three balance sheets from 2000 over time? So the first thing to notice is, is that people didn't talk about balance sheets from 2000 to 2007. It wasn't an interesting thing to talk about. But the balance sheets increased very gradually. They basically increased as currency and circulation was increasing. And nobody was really talking about balance sheets as being a significant tool for monetary policy. In the fall of 2007, when the financial crisis really started to be a problem in the United States, the first thing we had to do is address a very significant liquidity problems in financial markets. That included money market funds, that included the commercial paper market. So as a result of what was going on in short-term markets, we substantially increased our balance sheet very, very quickly to reflect the liquidity problems that we were having in the market. Over time, those liquidity problems were changed into an asset purchase program. And you can see that we were expanding our balance sheet quite significantly through this period, buying both long-term treasury securities and buying mortgage-backed securities for exactly the mechanism I was talking about before. We're trying to flatten the yield curve. We were constrained. We couldn't do anything at the short end of the market. We had to do something at the long end of the market, and that's exactly what we did. So the result was, instead of just dealing with reserves, which you normally do with the federal funds market, you're purchasing assets, and you can see that we got a very different solution historically in terms of what our balance sheet looked like. Now, I would highlight that in the United States, it was very aggressive at first, but we've also got to the point where while we started to hold our securities constant. So as those securities came due, if 5 years ago we bought a five-year treasury security, and it comes due today, we've just been reinvesting those proceeds. So that's had the impact of, that's why we have a flat line in the United States for bank assets, that we've been just buying back treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities to keep our portfolio constant. Now, because the balance sheet normally grows, it actually means that excess reserves are going down a little bit. So in some sense, as soon as we stopped growing our balance sheet, that was a tightening. So we have been, in some sense, tightening up on the balance sheet ever since we decided not to have it grow over time. Now you can see that Japan and Europe didn't grow nearly as quickly initially, but they're still having to expand their balance sheet because they're not getting the economic outcomes they want. They're still not hitting their inflation targets. And as a result, I would argue that by being very aggressive early on, it has meant that we've been able to stop a little bit sooner. This is a little clearer this is the chart that Peter had relative to GDP. I took it back to 2000, so this just highlights relative to GDP. Our balance sheets were a little bit different in 2000. But then if you look at it over time, yes, we expanded the balance sheet very quickly in the United States, but relative to the size of the economy, it seems a lot more manageable than what you've had in other central banks around the world. Particularly notable is what happened in Japan, where relative to GDP, they've really expanded their balance sheet in order to try to get their economy moving again. Peter also mentioned the yield curve differences, and so this is actually showing that as well. So if you look at the blue, which is the United States, or I guess it's purple, or whatever you want to call this, we've been fluctuating roughly 2.25, 2.5. It's a little soft recently. Since that time where we started to raise short-term rates and stabilize our balance sheet, the 10-year Treasury rate has been trading around a little bit above 2%. I showed you the chart that Japan and Europe have been continuing to do these asset purchases, and not surprisingly, you're seeing that the 10-year rate is going down. We know that the short-term rates are at zero, so it's a very different yield curve between the United States and those of Japan and various European countries. So that's where we've been. Let's talk a little bit more about why I think we're going to be back in this place fairly frequently, or at least around any significant economic downturn. So this is the summary of economic projections that I was talking about at the introduction to my remarks. So it's the 19 people that participate in monetary policy, the 12 Reserve Bank presidents and the 7 governors when we have all 7, which we haven't had for several years, but when we do have 7 governors. The dark blue in this chart is the median. So you can see the median back in January of 2012 was 4.25%. You can see the median right now is 3%. So the median has come down. The shaded area reflects the central tendency. The central tendency throws out the 3 highest observations and the 3 lowest observations, but just gives you an idea of how certain or uncertain people are in terms of how big a spread is there between the people that are being asked in the survey to come up with what they think the federal funds rate will be in the long run. So you can see that it was pretty uncertain in 2012. It's a little bit tighter now, but with the median at 3, there are an awful lot of people that actually think it could be lower than 3%. Well, that's actually a fairly substantial change in a relatively short period of time in where people think the interest rate's going to be in the long run. So if you're only at 3% or a little bit lower and you have a bad economic shock, you only have 300 basis points to move short-term rates before you're back to zero again. So there is a consequence to having a federal funds rate that is at a much lower rate, and I'm going to illustrate that with a couple of charts. So this chart shows you the federal funds rate over time. And you can see that they're red dots. So for each of the periods between recessions, I've looked at the low point and the high point. And other than this first period, where there was a relatively modest decline, you can see that many of the declines are actually quite substantial. You can see how little the recent increase seems relative to how much we've come down during recessions, the shadings reflecting recessions. So not surprisingly, during recessions, the Federal Reserve reacts by easing interest rates, it comes down. But you can see that if you only had 300 basis points, gee, you'd be hitting zero very, very frequently if it was a similar way that we would react. And in fact, this next chart just does the adding up for you. So it's looking at each of those peak periods, which are shown in chronological order in this first column. The second column shows you how much we caused the federal funds rate to decline from peak to trough in each of those recessions. And I would highlight where the high rate was here. So you can see in this column, you're seeing numbers like 6, 8%. So those are big declines in nominal interest rates at the short end of the market in order to try to get the economy to recover. And the reason we could do that is we had much higher interest rates to start from. So even though we were at much higher rates, you can see in the low column that the only time we actually hit zero was this last recession, which was both very severe, but we also didn't start at nearly as high a point as we have previously. So if you put in context a federal funds rate of 300 basis points and think about how we've responded in previous recessions using monetary policy, it has an implication for how frequently you're going to expect to be back in the situation we're in. The second chart does the same thing, but does a simple calculation to give you the real federal funds rate rather than the nominal federal funds rate. So all I've done is deflated by core PCE. So in round numbers, think that we have 2% inflation right now. We have a federal funds rate a little less than 1, but let's call it 1. So the real federal funds rate right now is 1 minus 2, negative 1. So you can see on this chart that we're roughly at negative 1%. Right here. So it's just showing you what the real federal funds rate is. Now, the reason I show it in real terms rather than just in nominal terms is that it highlights that it's not that uncommon to actually lower the federal funds rate enough that it's lower than the inflation rate, which means after inflation, you're getting a negative return. In fact, it's pretty common in previous recessions to actually get negative real interest rates. You can see in the 1970s, we were able to get quite negative. Now, one reason you can get so negative, one, you know the interest rate didn't get down to zero from the previous chart, but it got down to negative 4. Well, that reflects a much higher inflation rate at that time. The variation that you're seeing here, so you know from 2008, we were basically at zero. So this is basically showing you variation in core PCE. So if you have the federal funds rate bounded at zero, if you have an inflation rate only about 2%, you're only going to get negative 2% in real rate when you hit a recession. But you can see it's not that uncommon to have negative real rates. And again, this shows you the same chart in real terms. And so I would emphasize the lows here. So you can see it wasn't uncommon to get negative real rates in response to a recession. It is a little less common to have negative rates stay negative for as long as they have. So normally in a normal recovery, we wouldn't hit the zero lower bound, and relatively quickly we get off the negative real rates. But we weren't able to bring rates low enough to get that faster recovery because we only had an inflation rate that was less than 2%, so they couldn't get that negative. That's why we ended up having to use our balance sheet to try to actually affect the long end of the market as well. So you can see that it's quite likely, even in the past, that we would get negative real interest rates, but it was not so likely that you'd hit the zero lower bound. So there are some implications from this. We have a limited buffer, so if we're only going to be at 300 basis points in the long run, it means we don't have a very big buffer before we hit the zero lower bound. In terms of real rates, you might expect us to get there more frequently, and you might expect, particularly if we're slow to do balance sheet or other activities, that we might stay there for a little bit longer. In terms of the nominal federal funds rate, we're likely to hit zero much more frequently. So the implication of that is it's going to have to be more common for central banks in the course of a recession, as long as we're right that the short-term federal funds rate is going to stay low, that we're going to have to use asset purchases to stimulate the economy. So as we're thinking about our exit strategy right now, we shouldn't be thinking about this as a one-time event. We should be thinking about this as a common practice, unless we change the inflation target, or we're able to do something about the population and labor force growth, or something about productivity. If all those remain low, then we end up in a situation that I've just described. So let me just cover those three elements briefly to highlight why my expectation is, at least in the near term, those conditions aren't likely to change too dramatically. So you can see the inflation process in the United States has actually changed pretty dramatically. So during the period of oil shortages, we had very substantial increases in the inflation rate. One reason we were able to get so negative during this period was because we started from such high inflation rates, which meant we could bring the nominal rate down very substantially, and we could actually get a very low real interest rate. You can see since roughly the mid-80s that the Federal Reserve and many other central banks have been much more focused on hitting a 2% or around a 2% inflation target. And you can, while we didn't have it explicit, we had it implicitly, and more recently it is explicit. And you can see since the mid-90s, we have been fluctuating around that 2%. It has been relatively stable, particularly when you think about the severity of the economic shocks that we've seen more recently. So one reason why we're going to hit the zero lower bound more frequently is that we have an inflation rate that's much lower. Now, there are clearly some good things about low inflation, so I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It is a good thing, but we have to realize that a low inflation rate has an implication for how often we're going to use the balance sheet. If you pick a low inflation target, you're also picking less of a buffer, which means you're going to hit the zero lower bound more frequently, so you got to get more comfortable using the balance sheet, because that'll be the only other way that monetary policy is going to be able to stimulate the economy. Turning to productivity growth, now this is a heavily smoothed series. If I showed you output per hour without smoothing it, it would look like a seismic graph. It's all over the place. So what I've done is I've smoothed this over 40 quarters, 10 years, to give you an idea, because productivity is really something that's more of a long-run phenomena. Now, this is not something that economists think monetary policy can have much of an impact on. It can really matter what's happening in the education. Lots of things can affect productivity in terms of possibly tax policy and other fiscal measures, but it's not something monetary policy can do anything about. So it's basically a given for monetary policy. You can see that there have been periods where productivity has been low in the United States. There have been periods where productivity has been very high. But more recently, the productivity in the United States has been quite low. Again, that's an attribute that you see not only in the United States, but many other countries. So if you have very low productivity, that's not an environment where you're going to expect an equilibrium interest rate that's particularly high. You're not going to have nearly as much investment in a world where we have very low productivity. Similarly, the labor force has changed pretty dramatically. Again, it's a little bit noisy, but in the 60s going up to the 70s, we had some fairly rapid increases in population that reflected higher birth rates, that reflected reasonably high immigration patterns.
and it reflected women coming from outside the labor force into the labor force. So we had some significant increases in the labor force initially, but all three of those trends are reversing themselves. The birth rate has come down. We're unlikely to have very substantial immigration over the next couple of years, I think we can safely say. And there's no reason to expect that we're going to have a huge inflow of women. The participation rate's already quite high in the economy. So the result is that the labor force trend, that green line, looks like it's going to be flatter. So again, if you have a slower population growth, if the demographics are slowing you down, then you're not going to need to have as high an equilibrium interest rate. So when you put those three graphs together, we have a lower inflation rate, we have lower productivity, and we have a population that's not going to be growing, a labor force that's not going to be growing particularly fast. So one, there's going to be a trade-off between that inflation target and how often you're willing to manipulate the balance sheet. Choosing a low inflation target is also choosing that more than likely you're going to be hitting negative real rates and zero nominal rates more frequently. It's not unique to the United States. I don't want to speak for Peter, but my guess is the same thing holds in Europe, and the same thing is likely to hold in Japan. So it's actually a global phenomenon. It's going to be a general issue for central banks. And so balance sheet tools are going to be a necessary feature of recessions unless one of those three variables changes. So in conclusion, I see it quite likely that central banks in the future are going to have to use balance sheet. So it means it's important for us to try to get this right, not only for the economy right now, but this is actually a playbook for the future too. We can't assume that this is a one-time event. In my own view, now that we're very close to both our inflation and employment target, it is appropriate to be shrinking our balance sheet. I would argue the sooner the better, that we should start shrinking the balance sheet now that the federal funds rate is off the zero bound. But we should do it gradually enough that we don't disrupt financial markets. So initially that means that we still repurchase a lot of those securities. We only allow a little of them to run off at first, but that grows over time. In effect, I'm arguing that the balance sheet should be something that's occurring in the background, but doesn't have much of an impact in terms of whether we think the federal funds rate should go up or down. We would use the federal funds rate, the variable that we know a lot more about in terms of we have a long historical experience with it. We'll use that to adjust the economy. Hopefully we have a very nice long recovery. We get a normalized balance sheet. We get interest rates to a more normal level. But whenever we do get that negative shock, we shouldn't be shocked if 300 basis points isn't enough and we actually have to then use the balance sheet again. So that concludes my remarks. I'd be glad to take some questions.